This video will focus on various neuropsychiatric disorders in which disturbances of cognitive behavior have been identified. Standard diagnostic techniques, including magnetic resonance imaging and neuropsychological batteries, will be used to illustrate how highly focal, regionally localized, or diffuse forms of pathology are characterized in routine clinical practice. The disorders that will be illustrated will include one focal form of pathology, cerebrovascular accident or stroke, and one regionally localized form of pathology, senile dementia of the Alzheimer type. In addition, we will also consider two psychiatric disorders, schizophrenia and manic depressive illness, in which neither focal nor regionally defined pathology can be identified. In the most general terms, this video will seek to demonstrate that disorders which are very different with respect to their underlying pathophysiology, course, and prognosis can nevertheless result in disturbances of thinking, memory, and emotion. We will carefully dissect out the unique characteristics of different clinical entities, and we will try to demonstrate that the pathological processes causing a common cognitive disturbance like memory loss and thought disorder are often quite different. Finally, this video will also address the question of how brain dysfunction in psychiatric illness can lead to profound disruptions of normal cognition, yet result in no striking or consistent changes observable with either brain imaging or microscopic techniques. A common form of focal brain injury that can result in cognitive disturbances is the cerebrovascular accident. These so-called CVAs, more commonly referred to as strokes, typically affect large numbers of elderly individuals. Strokes can either arise from hemorrhages or occlusions of arterial branches that supply different regions of the brain. Depending upon where a stroke occurs, a wide variety of neurological and psychological deficits may occur. The most common variety of deficit observed in stroke patients involves losses of sensory and motor function in the face, arms, and legs. These strokes often involve occlusion of the arterial branches that supply the portions of the brain involved in these functions, as shown in the diagram in blue and red. Many individuals who experience a stroke, however, show not only motor and sensory deficits, but also changes arising from occlusion of arterial branches that supply frontal and temporal portions of the brain. One of these regions, called Wernicke's area, plays an essential role in the formation of language. There is a posterior cerebral artery, as shown in this diagram, which is only partially visible on the lateral surface of the brain. If we look at a mid-sagittal view of the human brain, we can see that the posterior cerebral artery supplies the occipital lobe where the primary visual cortex is located. When individuals experience a stroke affecting the posterior cerebral artery, they develop a characteristic form of blindness, which is only detectable by a physician. There are other types of strokes that result in the loss of normal functioning related to the frontal portions of the brain. In one of these strokes, there is a bilateral occlusion of the anterior cerebral artery that supplies most of the medial aspect of the hemispheres. As you can see in the diagram, this artery supplies a gyrus that sits above the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum is an enormous bundle of neuronal fibers that provides communication between the left and right hemispheres of the brain. Individuals who experience an anterior cerebral artery occlusion develop a syndrome called akinetic mutism, in which they cease to speak or to move. It is very similar to catatonia seen in patients with schizophrenia and other forms of psychotic disorder. Patients with akinetic mutism who have recovered from their stroke report that at the instant that the stroke occurred, they stopped experiencing emotion and no longer felt the need to speak or to move. This syndrome, observed with anterior cerebral artery occlusion, serves to illustrate the degree to which emotional experience is integrated with other higher cognitive functions such as thinking, perception, attention, and motivation. There are many other strokes affecting the frontal lobes that can result in disturbances in these aspects of cognitive behavior. We are now going to examine two patients, one who has experienced a highly localized stroke and another who has a regional form of pathology, senile dementia of the Alzheimer type.
Mrs. Q is a 77-year-old woman with a history of left-sided weakness and no subjective complaints of language or memory difficulties. She appears intelligent and friendly and reports that she has always been an avid reader. However, she reports a recent inability to concentrate. On tests of overall intellectual ability, memory function, and organization, the most notable finding is her poor visual recall compared to her intact verbal learning. To further examine her visual memory functions, Mrs. Q is given the Ray-Osterhees complex figure and asked to copy it using a paper and colored pens. Her copy is piecemeal, and she has obvious difficulty integrating the parts. Her recall after 4 minutes reflects the originally disjointed attempt. She has to be encouraged to produce even a few fragments, which she manages. This performance seems typical of right frontal impairment. It is noteworthy that her copy of simpler figures is much closer to normal. Her difficulty becomes more pronounced as the material becomes increasingly complex, thus requiring greater organizational skills. Memory for language-based information is intact as measured by the California Verbal Learning Test, which is designed to assess verbal learning and memory. The difficulty Mrs. Q encounters on the block design subtest appears to be largely of the frontal problem-solving variety. She has much difficulty with embedded designs, but succeeds where single-block copying of separate sections of the design suffices. In summary, Mrs. Q experiences difficulty with tasks involving visuospatial organization and construction. These deficits in right hemisphere function are in sharp contrast with very good performances on standard tasks of intelligence and verbal memory. Examination of language reveals no dysphasic elements.
Mrs. Q is a 77-year-old woman who has had a large stroke in the right frontal lobe. The area of infarction is easily seen on multiple images taken in different orientations and is located in the right superior frontal lobe. The unusual appearance of the lesion, which is very light in some images and very dark in others, is due to resolving blood. Surrounding the lesion is an area of abnormal tissue, which is termed reactive tissue change, and there is even an area of tissue loss. Most cerebral infarctions are bland, that is, they are not associated with cerebral hemorrhage. In an elderly patient like Mrs. Q, the origin of her stroke may have been weakened blood vessel walls. Other sources of cerebral hemorrhage include vascular malformations and tumors. Mrs. Q will probably be asked to undergo repeat brain imaging in approximately 6 months to better determine the etiology of her stroke. Strokes, like those affecting Mrs. Q, can arise in many different locations within the brain, depending upon where the hemorrhage or occlusion occurs. In contrast, There are many different other types of central nervous system disease that may also affect only certain brain regions while sparing others. Such disorders may be caused by an underlying neuropathological process that is triggered by well-defined factors, while in other disorders, the underlying process may be idiopathic. When the word idiopathic is used, it simply means that physicians do not currently know what the cause is, even though a neuropathologist may be able to carefully describe the types of changes that typically occur when brain tissue from a patient with such a disorder is observed under the microscope. We will discuss one example of regional brain pathology, senile dementia of the Alzheimer type, in which it is not well established.
The regional form of pathology that we will discuss was first described by a German neuropathologist named Alzheimer. Alzheimer's disease is a disorder that characteristically afflicts the elderly population and generally does not begin to appear until approximately 65 years of age. The risk of contracting Alzheimer's disease increases steadily with advancing years. Patients with this disorder will initially show only subtle indications that something is wrong. The first symptom that may become apparent to family members and friends is a loss of memory. The memory loss is usually accompanied by other disturbances of logic and language function. Later, however, impairments of memory may be followed by subtle changes in the personality, including apathy, lack of spontaneity, and social withdrawal. Eventually, patients with Alzheimer's disease become mute and completely inattentive to their surrounding environment. It is the memory loss, however, that is the hallmark feature of Alzheimer's disease.
Mrs. J is a 73-year-old female who was referred for evaluation of overall level of cognitive functioning. Her ability to care for herself has decreased over the past year, and she's had to stop driving because she would frequently drive the wrong way down one-way streets. A previous neurological exam identified deficits in word production, ability to follow directions, and learning ability. Mrs. J is unable to give a coherent history and is uncertain about basic familial information. Her level of cognitive impairment is seen on a screening test where Mrs. J is unable to answer basic questions. Her current level of overall intellectual ability is low average. As frequently is the case with Alzheimer's disease, her performance on tests of visuospatial functions are more profoundly affected than her performance on tests of verbal functions. For example, on a test of the ability to assemble puzzles into meaningful objects, she scored in the impaired range. She had difficulty attending to visual detail and integrating components into a whole. On a second task, where she was asked to draw a clock set at 11:10, she was able to produce a clock face, although she was unable to produce numbers, and set the time by placing a superscript 10 next to the 11. The results from Mrs. J's neuropsychological testing indicate an individual functioning below her estimated premorbid cognitive potential. There is a relative preservation of verbal skills with a clear decline in concentration, integration ability, learning and retrieval of new information, and poor visuospatial abilities. These results are consistent with bilateral cortical dysfunction, primarily of the temporal and frontal regions.
Mrs. J has pronounced problems with her memory, and from the history given above, she would probably meet diagnostic criteria for probable Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive disorder. While the earliest symptoms may involve difficulty in learning and retaining new material, advanced symptoms can be much more severe and wide-ranging, including changes in behavior, mood, and thought processes. The neuroimaging findings in patients with Alzheimer's disease also reflect the clinical heterogeneity of patients with the disorder. The earliest pathological findings probably involve the hippocampus, an irregularly shaped gray matter structure located in the medial temporal lobe. Longitudinal studies of patients with Alzheimer's disease suggest that the degree of hippocampal atrophy parallels the degree of clinical impairment. On brain MRI, Mrs. J has pronounced bilateral hippocampal atrophy. In addition to this focal finding, Mrs. J also has a substantial amount of both central and cortical atrophy. The central atrophy is most clearly seen by the marked expansion of the lateral ventricles. In this image, the ventricular spaces are filled with cerebrospinal fluid and appear as white cavities in the center of the brain. Cortical atrophy can be most easily seen at the margins of the image, where white cerebrospinal fluid extends with finger-like projections into the surface of the brain. Extensive brain atrophy is characteristic of patients with more advanced Alzheimer's disease.
Unlike the two neuropsychiatric disorders that you have just seen, stroke and Alzheimer's disease, there are other forms of cognitive disturbance for which focal or regional changes cannot be demonstrated with either brain imaging or neuropathological evaluation. These disorders are generally those that are diagnosed and treated by psychiatrists and psychologists. Two of the most common and perplexing mental illnesses in which non-localized disturbances are observed are schizophrenia and manic depressive illness. As we will illustrate, although both of these disorders are associated with significant cognitive disturbances, the changes in thinking that are observed are quite different. The first systematic descriptions of schizophrenia were made by Emil Kraepelin, a German psychiatrist who worked in the last part of the 19th century. Kraepelin was the first to note that this disorder typically appears between 16 and 25 years of age and is characterized by hallucinations, delusions, and disturbances in both the form and content of thinking. Patients with schizophrenia also show marked impairments in motivation, attention, emotional expression, social interactiveness, and their sense of who they are. Patients with this disorder often show a progressive deterioration over a period of 10 to 15 years. Later, they often pass into a so-called burnout period in which the illness becomes less severe and more manageable. The changes that occur during the midlife period often seem like an improvement because there is a decrease of the hallucinations and delusions. Unfortunately, schizophrenic patients who burn out are typically left in a so-called defect state in which the disturbances of motivation, attention, affect, and social interactiveness persist and continue to cause severe impairment. The thinking of a schizophrenic before, during, and after this burnout period is often illogical and bizarre.
From the first descriptions of the phenomenology of schizophrenia and manic depressive illness, disturbances in thinking have been acknowledged as central features. When Kraepelin described dementia praecox, which is now called schizophrenia, he considered derailment of thinking to be a cardinal feature of the disorder. Thought disorder per se is a generic description of a group of cognitive disturbances. Disturbances in thinking are found in both schizophrenia and manic depressive illness, and in organic psychoses stemming from toxic, metabolic, and neuropathologic conditions. The forms that thought disorder takes, however, are quite different in these various conditions. In schizophrenia, thinking can be arbitrary and disorganized. These characteristics may be manifested in autistic logic, absurd notions, confusion, and even incoherent statements. Boundaries between discrete ideas or percepts become blurred so that one percept fluidly merges into another, or independent ideas are joined idiosyncratically. This process can serve as the basis for misperceptions, misinterpretations, and erroneous conclusions. When elaborated into beliefs of delusional proportions, such ideas can guide behavior in unrealistic, sometimes dangerous ways, because the beliefs acquire a peremptory, compelling quality to the patient. Deviant use of language is one of the most common indications of cognitive slippage in schizophrenics. In contrast, in mania, associative looseness, expansiveness, and compulsive embellishment of unrelated ideas are typical manifestations of thought disorder. Delusional thinking is common during floridly psychotic states in schizophrenics and manic depressives. Delusional thinking involves a rigidly held belief that has no reality endorsement. The content of the delusional ideas associated with each clinical syndrome, however, is quite different. Grandiose delusions, such as thinking that one has special powers or abilities, which may be acted upon with great energy and exuberance, are commonly seen in manic states. Erotic preoccupations, in which even sexually neutral ideas acquire sexual significance, are also typical of acute mania. In the following excerpt from a tape interview, the patient believes that she was born with a set of law books inside her, but this delusional idea occurs in a context of general disorganization, confusion, absurdity, and autistic logic.
Well, no one's supposed to be sensitive to words.
Mm-hmm. Like what words?
Any word.
Give me some words that people are sensitive to.
Well, it depends. As long as you have a breath in your body, you're ill. You see, if people would get to the point with me, I could get to the point with them. Actually, you see, like when we go to court, like when I go to court for you, when we need more kitchens and things like that, you know, United States Supreme Court, you know, sometimes, you know, we're in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right, sir?
Very
you
true.
See, I was born with a set of law books up in me.
Inside your body?
Yes, sir, a whole set of law books. If I went to court, I could prosecute because they're all missing.
The connection between separate ideas is loose and at times incoherent, and she describes her belief in language that includes many deviant verbalizations, including stilted use of language and neologisms.
You see, I'm AWOL from Second and Luzerne.
AWOL from Second and Luzerne.
Yes, sir.
What's that?
I major in tuberculosis.
I mean, you had tuberculosis.
So you're looking at fibrocavernous tuberculosis infiltration on the right. How do you say it? Apical or apical?
Apical.
Apical apricots.
Apical apricots?
Yes, sir.
You had TB,
sir,
by the way?
Sir, I'm Taurus the Bull.
Did you, did you have TB, really?
Or did
you?
I have, no, sir, I didn't have it until I got in there.
Another patient, whose thinking is also absurd and arbitrary, expresses these psychotic convictions in language that is so peculiar that it is difficult to understand what he means.
And I can reach for some, though.
You can reach?
I can reach for voices.
What do you mean, reaching for voices?
Reach out for people.
What do you mean, reach for voices?
Through my head.
How do you do that?
Talk back to the back of my mouth.
I don't know what you mean.
I can talk back and reach out into space. Like I could talk to Howard Hughes.
Oh, you mean you can communicate?
I can communicate from here.
Oh, I see.
And I can reach out for voices and get answers.
Paranoid delusions are not specific to any one psychotic disorder, although they are not as typical of manic states as they are of certain subtypes of schizophrenia and of depression. Of course, paranoid delusions are also the central symptom associated with pure delusional disorder. Paranoid delusions usually require a certain level of organized thinking to sustain. The previous patients are capable of having paranoid ideas, but their thinking is too disorganized and arbitrary to allow any single psychotic idea to acquire precedence. The next two examples, provided by two different paranoid schizophrenics, illustrate paranoid delusions. These examples make clear that the confabulatory nature of delusional ideas, that is, making up a story, inherently involves establishing connections between unrelated ideas, inferential reasoning, and embellishment. Isolated notions that become incorporated into delusional ideas may in fact be true, but the interpretation that is extrapolated is not driven by an anchor in reality. In the first example to be presented, there may in fact be many Italians on the patient's ward, but this fact is elaborated in a referential and persecutory way that has no reality justification.
There's so many, there are a lot of Italians on the ward. They may be up to, I think they are what? How to get me, because this is what some time ago we had to get rid of a dealer who lived in, and it's possible that he, and then I had to fire a salesman who's also Italian. It's possible that they want revenge for that.
In the next example, autistic logic is used to justify the delusional belief, which originates in an isolated fact that is true. That is, that there are wires in walls.
You felt your feet were warm.
What they were warm.
Okay, they were warm. What does that have to do with electricity?
It had a lot to do with it, because when you look at the walls, you see open wires.
Right.
Have you ever seen a fuse box?
Sure.
The inside of it.
Sure.
Have you ever seen the telephone company when they install things?
Yeah.
And when they go there, you see how you have all those red, yellow, green, and blue
wires? Right. Yeah.
Well, then this is what was there. It wasn't my magic.
Oh, and that was making your feet warm. Right? Okay.
Several of the previous excerpts have illustrated deviant use of language, which is one of the most characteristic features of the thought disorder of schizophrenics. The most common form of deviant verbalization is using a word or phrase in a way that sounds stilted or peculiar. In contrast to delusions, peculiar word usage seems to be a trait characteristic of the thought disorder of schizophrenics. It occurs during acute psychotic episodes and also during remissions.
In other words, I had taken the LSD, and now I know that it caused a biochemical reaction to that amplified, things from my apex, my subconscious, specifically my apex, and my brain and the mind, you're familiar with that, I'm sure.
The videotape excerpts you just saw provide numerous examples of the kinds of thought disorder found in schizophrenics. Ideally, assessments of thought disorder are carried out in a systematic way using a validated metric for identifying and quantifying the kind and amount of thought disorder that is present. A number of methods have been developed, and we will next illustrate one of them, the Thought Disorder Index, or TDI. TDI scores are based on verbal responses to the Rorschach ink blots. In principle, any verbal sample will suffice, including interview material like that presented earlier. As indicated above, deviant use of language is characteristic of the thought disorder of schizophrenics. One doesn't need to see the picture that elicited the deviant verbalization to recognize how strange it sounds. Cranial skull. Some skeletal resemblance. Rectangularly speaking. Heads of approximately a human dimension. Some kind of botanical construction. The most severe form of deviant verbalization is neologism, or creating a word that does not exist in reality. What are levatory steps? What is a megatoid? Autistic logic can also be illustrated in responses to Rorschach ink blots. In this instance also, the specific picture that elicited the response is irrelevant to the arbitrary and illogical reasoning. The patient sees two pants legs in this picture, and the examiner asks, "What makes it look like two pants legs?" The patient responds, "Well, because it wasn't the skull, it's got to be pants legs." The examiner asks, "Could you explain that a little more?" And the patient replies, "Well, skulls deteriorate and pants legs don't."
Manic depressive illness is another common psychiatric condition. In this disorder, however, psychical changes in mood are characteristically present. When manic, patients with this disorder require very little sleep, become energized, expansive, grandiose, and even socially disruptive. The thinking of a manic patient is verbose and rambling, and a manic patient may even show a flight of ideas in which they jump from one idea to another. It is difficult for a patient in a manic state to sustain a continuous, intelligible stream of thought. In contrast, when depressed, patients with manic depressive illness have very little energy or motivation. They feel hopeless and often exhibit suicidal thoughts and behavior. Most individuals with manic depressive illness show complete remission of their abnormal mood states and can return to a relatively normal state. At a later time, however, they can again decompensate, particularly when exposed to stressful conditions.
The thinking of manic patients is loose and extravagant, and unrelated ideas are compulsively embellished, often in ways that are playful and funny. One idea blends into another without any obvious connection or bridge linking consecutive thoughts. This excerpt from an interview with a manic patient illustrates his elevated mood, his expansiveness, and the looseness of his associations.
"And my choosing to do things realistic, to try to get things done efficaciously, I think is a very good example of my brilliance. I started to ask you, my throat is parched. Couldn't I please have some water or something?"
Right, and that's...
"And you said in 10 minutes. And you're the boss."
The hypersexual orientation of the manic can be seen by the gratuitous introduction of sexual material where it is irrelevant, which of course includes looseness in thinking as well.
About the hallucination, the voices,
yes.
What did the voices say?
Nothing. They were just sounds of things like in the picnic, childhood memories of water and waiting for my father, and my father masturbating maybe. No, my father wasn't masturbating. Springs like at a picnic, you know, like the rustling of people, maybe. I'm not sure. They're really fairly, I would say, low-level hallucinations. as opposed to seeing monsters coming up on you and crawling around and doing all sorts of things and grabbing your balls or whatever, you know.
The flippancy and playfulness of the manic also comes out in irrelevant comments that sidetrack one from the task at hand. In this case, continuity in the interview.
All my life, I've always been somewhat afraid of the dark. I don't mean to be tricky, but I am.
Yes, you are.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Okay.
The time. How long were you...
It's about 5 minutes before I can drink some water. That's the time. That's brilliant. Yeah. Or at least very smart.
Wordplay and looseness can also be illustrated by comments like...
But I don't want it to be too obvious to people that I'm sane, because otherwise I'll be back on the street again. And it rhymes like schizophrenic, but I'm not schizophrenic. I'm really quite sane.
What's the alternative to being on the street, then?
Working.
The disinhibition of behavior that can be seen in extravagant shopping sprees, increased motor activity, and flight of ideas also applies to the content of what is said to other people. Under normal circumstances, such statements would be inhibited because they are either rude or inappropriate.
Oh, I always have trouble on the job with people because I'm very honest. I tell them, you know, you're a schmuck, or you're a homosexual or something, you know.
The Rorschach response counterpart of delusional thinking is confabulation. Percepts that may be quite popular are embellished into a story by combining discrete images in different parts of the inkblot as if their physical proximity justified a relationship between them or an elaboration of the specific nature of the relationship. The content of the confabulation determines the nature of the psychotic elaboration. For example, it is not uncommon to see two people doing something on this card, or to see the image in the middle as hearts. The manic patient finds a relationship between the people and the hearts that is typical of the erotic preoccupations during an acute episode and the tendency to find connections between unrelated things. For example, the patient might say, "This is two people. They're dancing. They love each other so much their hearts are popping out of their bodies." In contrast, delusional elaboration of a paranoid nature lacks the playfulness and energy of the manic, but also finds relationships between different parts of the picture which become the basis for an internally generated script. The preceding section on thought disorder has demonstrated the many varieties of thought disorder encountered in psychotic conditions and illustrated the differences between the nature of the disturbed thinking found in schizophrenia and in manic depressive illness. Illogical thinking, incoherence, odd or peculiar word usage, extravagant combinations of ideas, and fixed unrealistic beliefs are all symptoms that implicate abnormal functioning of the brain. In between manic episodes, the thinking of the manic frequently returns to normal, and prior to the first episode of either disorder, signs of these disturbances are frequently absent. The different manifestations of thought disorder found in the two conditions and their different propensities to remit between acute episodes suggest that the neuropathological or neurochemical basis underlying these interruptions of normal cognition may also be different.
As you have seen, there are many different ways in which disturbances of thinking can arise. On the one hand, there are the acute onset neurological disorders in which focal pathology, like that arising from a stroke, can suddenly result in impairments of memory and other aspects of cognitive function. Then there are other disorders, such as Alzheimer's disease, where one particular brain region is involved in memory dysfunction. So in each of these clinical cases presented, one with stroke and one with Alzheimer's disease, a loss of memory is observed, yet the underlying mechanism responsible for the memory loss is quite different. In patients with stroke, blood flow to a key region like the medial temporal area may be blocked and result in a profound loss of neurons along the distribution of the artery that supplies that area. In Alzheimer's disease, on the other hand, there are characteristic pathological changes that can be observed under a microscope using a special staining technique that was developed by a pathologist named Bielchowski. These changes include small triangular-shaped structures called tangles that represent the debris of dead neurons. There are also much larger structures called senile plaques that are comprised of degenerating neuronal material. The accumulation of large numbers of senile plaques is considered to be a reliable indicator of how advanced the dementia of Alzheimer's disease has become. In fact, it has been found that the numbers of plaques correlates very highly with the degree of memory impairment observed in a given patient with Alzheimer's disease. These senile plaques contain an abnormal accumulation of a protein called beta amyloid. In the hippocampus, an important component of the temporal lobe, plaque formation is associated with a profound loss of neurons in this region. Paul Broca was a neuroanatomist who first called attention to the fact that the hippocampus was part of a contiguous loop found along the medial surface of the human brain. Broca went on to demonstrate that the parahippocampal gyrus, together with the cingulate gyrus, which lies above the corpus callosum, is similar throughout all mammalian species. What is notable is that the hippocampus and cingulate gyrus both have extensive connections with other more primitive parts of the brain. Broca believed, and correctly so, that the limbic lobe plays a central role in emotional experience. It was not until some time later, during the early 20th century, that a Czech neuropathologist named Pepez drew attention to the fact that there was a unique loop of connections associated with Broca's limbic lobe. This loop permitted the hippocampus and cingulate gyrus to communicate with one another. The so-called loop of Pepez, as it came to be called, is part of a key relay of information not only between the hippocampus and frontal portions of the cingulate gyrus, but also the cerebral cortex. As first suggested by Pepez, this system plays a central role in the integration of emotion with higher cognitive functions. To illustrate, when you study intensively for an exam, you are driven by the fear of failure and the joy of success. Stated differently, the greater the intensity of emotion, the faster will you remember. Now let's turn our attention to schizophrenia and manic depressive illness. For these two disorders, only inconsistent and nonspecific changes have been found using brain imaging techniques. Recent studies suggest, however, that the brain areas that may be affected in these psychiatric disorders include the hippocampal formation and the other key component of the loop of Pepez, the cingulate gyrus. As you heard, the hippocampus is implicated in the memory deficits of Alzheimer's disease. Although we do not usually observe memory loss in schizophrenia, several other categories of behavior that are abnormal in schizophrenia and manic depressive illness are also affected in Alzheimer's disease. These behaviors include disturbances in thinking, emotional expression, attention, motivation, and social interactiveness. All of these behaviors can be traced either directly or indirectly to the loop of Pepez. Interestingly, in schizophrenia, brain imaging studies have demonstrated shrinkage of the hippocampal region and, to a lesser extent, the frontal lobes. Remarkably, when tissue from patients with either schizophrenia or manic depressive illness is viewed under a microscope, it looks generally quite normal. How can it be that brain imaging studies can show shrinkage of the hippocampus, but by looking through the microscope at tissues from patients with these two disorders, there are not obvious degenerative changes like those seen in Alzheimer's disease? It is now widely believed that schizophrenia probably involves very subtle but functionally important changes in neural circuitry, not only within the temporal lobe, but also the frontal lobes as well. These changes can only be detected using highly sophisticated neurobiologic approaches to assess specific neurotransmitter systems. This photomicrograph demonstrates such an approach. A major projection neuron of the cortex, shown in orange, has been visualized using a special antibody preparation that can detect its neurotransmitter, an amino acid called glutamate. Surrounding the neuron, shown in green, is a dense network or plexus of neuronal fibers that have been visualized with a similar technique. The images are obtained with a special form of microscopy in which lasers are used to visualize fluorescent emissions of two different wavelengths. The GABAergic fibers, as shown in green, provide inhibitory modulation of the projection neuron. By looking at this micrograph, you can appreciate how enormously complex the wiring surrounding the projection neuron must be. You can also imagine that a disorder like schizophrenia, in which there is illogical thinking, could involve a miswiring of such inputs to projection cells. In contrast to schizophrenia, manic depressive disorder seems to involve altered neurochemical modulation at the level of the synapse. Most patients with manic depressive illness typically return to a relatively normal state after their mood disturbance has been resolved. This implies that the hard wiring present in patients with manic depressive illness may be relatively normal. The episodic changes of mood may involve parallel changes in the regulation of neuronal activity along circuits that are otherwise wired correctly. A dysregulation of such a neural circuit could involve abnormalities in the synthesis, storage, release, or metabolism of a particular neurotransmitter. Think of how the playing of a piano can, on the one hand, be harsh and shrill, or on the other, slow and ponderous. So, in contrast to schizophrenia, where microscopic approaches are needed to identify how the hard wiring of the brain is altered, the dramatic changes in mood that are seen in patients with manic depressive illness will probably be unraveled at the molecular level. In summary, we have examined several different forms of neuropsychiatric illness in which there are four different patterns of brain pathology. These have included gross focal lesions, as in stroke, diffuse regional changes detectable with routine microscopic analysis, as in Alzheimer's disease, discrete alterations of hard wiring requiring sophisticated neuroanatomic approaches, as in schizophrenia, and dysregulation of neurotransmitter activity, as in manic depressive illness. As we have seen, there are obvious differences in the various neuropsychiatric disorders that we have discussed. Nevertheless, each one involves significant disturbances in thinking.